It is my great pleasure to meet and introduce and welcome Tania Sheehan for the first paper. Tania Sheehan is Associate Professor of Art History at Colby College in Maine. She has written extensively on race in American art and photography, and she's written about other subjects too, but that's what she has been focusing on recently. Most recently, she contributed an essay entitled A Time and a Place, Rethinking Race in American Art History, to the newly published anthology A Companion to American Art. She has also recently edited two books, one called Photography and Its Origins, very recently. In that project, she was actually my boss, so I'm quite happy to have her here. And in the other one, called Photography History Difference. Her presentation today is actually an expansion of an article she recently published in the magazine American Art, in the very recent issue. And it is called The Politics of Erasure, Writing American Art History in Black and White. And in this presentation, she problematizes current approaches to discussing race using the work of Jacob Lawrence as a frame for her discussion. Please join me in welcoming Tania Sheehan.
Thank you, Francois. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you to everybody who organized this conference. It's been a great pleasure being here. Okay. To address the issue highlighted in this conference, namely the erasures and denials that have defined American art history, I want to begin with a swift historiographical tour. One that focuses on the incorporation of black bodies into the American canon. In the second half of the 20th century, U.S. institutions were turning their attention more than ever before to African American subjects and producers of art. Such attention took two significant forms. First, black figures in the art of John Singleton Copley, Winslow Homer, Thomas Aikens, and other master painters became the focus of exhibitions accompanied by publications. Those studies were led by The Portrayal of the Negro in American Painting, an exhibition mounted at Bowdoin College in 1964. And they culminated in 1990 with the Corcoran Gallery of Art's survey, Facing History. The Corcoran's exhibition and its catalog, edited by Guy McElroy, were more ambitious and influential than Bowdoin's, aiming to document comprehensively representations of black figures across artistic media from the colonial period to the mid-20th century. But the two projects ultimately enacted the same gesture, uncovering the black image in the American artistic canon without altering fundamentally the canon itself. A second form of attention to black subjects and black artists resulted in more permanent institutional changes. Museums and galleries devoted to African American art and culture were established, among them the Studio Museum in Harlem, whose facade is on the left. At the same time, historically white institutions across the US, such as the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Whitney Museum of American Art, and the LA County Museum of Art, began recognizing African American artistic production as a valued object of study. These developments gestured toward an expansion of the American canon to include painters such as Robert Scott Duncanson, Henry Osawa Tanner, and Jacob Lawrence. The 20th century thus saw the consolidation of two distinct and institutionalized fields of study in the United States, One placed white representations of black bodies in a critical light, and the other showcased the art created by Americans of African descent. The former field is known today as Image of the Black Studies, and the latter as African American art history. As the millennium approached, many scholars were acknowledging the value of illuminating once invisible bodies and empowering long silent voices. Others were critiquing the new methods of inclusion. In 1999, for instance, art historian Kimberly Pinder objected to the ways in which images of and by African Americans were set apart from art history's so-called primary subjects and asked to adhere to strict, often stereotypical definitions of minority representation. Writing in the Art Bulletin, which is the flagship journal of the US's College Art Association, Pinder contended that a black body could only enter a Western survey textbook as naive, unsophisticated, indigent, hypersexualized, and always already raced. Among the troubling image selections to which she drew our attention were that of Reginald Marsh's Why Not Take the L from 1930 and Jacob Lawrence's Interior Scene from 1937, which appeared together in the 1995 edition of Marilyn Stockstad's Art History. And for those of you that don't know this book, this is probably the most widely used textbook for art history in the US. Their juxtaposition in Stockstad made it impossible for readers to see, quote, the black artist as equal to his white contemporaries, Pinder argued, because they were encouraged to imagine Lawrence as either the dozing figure on Marsh's subway or what she called the complicit voyeur or pimp in Lawrence's own brothel scene. For this reason, it became productive to maintain a distance between the image of the black in US art history, represented by Marsh, and African American art, represented by Lawrence. With racial stereotypes in the white imagination critically segregated from black artistic production, in other words, readers could generate positive images of blackness. But this practice also presented a potential problem. It distanced African American art history even further from US art history, denying the deep connections between the two. So let me restate the problem as it was formulated at the turn of the 21st century. The incorporation of black subjects and artists into art history in the United States perpetuated the marginalization of African Americans that had stimulated historiographical changes in the first place. Although many textbook authors have reduced content and structures that promote racial stereotyping, the core of this problem lives on. If anything, the divide between Image of the Black Studies and African American art history has grown even wider, as scholars are rethinking the role that race plays in art created by African Americans. An excellent example of such rethinking is Darby English's How to See a Work of Art in Total Darkness, published in 2007. The book critiques what English calls black representational space, or a set of institutionalized practices that limits discussions of African American art to what it has to say about blackness. English's aim is to release black art from the yoke of racialization by placing it in dialogue with art that appears to erase or deny racial discourses altogether. The cut paper silhouettes of Kara Walker, for instance, enter into dialogue in his book with the abstract wall painting of Blinky Palermo, the conceptual art of Lawrence Feener, and much more. English thus teaches us that African American art history belongs in direct conversation with US and European art histories. But he argues that it can do so only if race, and specifically blackness, is omitted from the discussion. This move is liberating, for sure, but it can ultimately restrict more than it enables. Today, I want to reflect on those restrictions, on the limits we place on what and how we see when it comes to African-American art, by framing them as a problem that art historians need to develop new ways of tackling. A specific case study will motivate my discussion, a painting by Jacob Lawrence titled Taboo that dates to 1963 and which became the subject of an essay I published in the journal American Art in fall 2014. I chose to revisit the painting in the context of this conference because its interpretation has been defined by the particular critical erasures and denials that I have begun to highlight here. That is, readings of Taboo have been limited by scholars' reluctance to see white images of blackness in works by certain celebrated African-American artists. Artists who, like Lawrence, have been promoted as spokespersons for and exemplars of black life and culture. I believe such reluctance stems from good intentions, but it nevertheless occludes the work's multiple significations and the artist's capacity to mine popular visual culture, including negative images of the black. The scant writing on Taboo interprets the figures in the painting as two pairs of newlyweds participating in a double wedding. On the left, a man in a black top hat and suit with white gloves and facial skin tones stands arm in arm with his bride, a woman with a dark brown face who holds a red bouquet and wears a sharply angled white dress. On the right, the figures are arranged similarly, although there are marked differences in the coloration of their skin and of the bride's dress and flowers. The gentleman now appears with a dark brown face, while the woman has a much lighter face, her body framed by yellow highlights. The painting's title has encouraged viewers to read these four figures, two black and two white, as having challenged the taboo against interracial marriage. In 1963, there were still anti-miscegenation laws in the United States, particularly in the southern states, which made the act depicted not only a social transgression, but also a felony. Read in this context, Taboo becomes a celebration of two couples' courage in the face of adversity, and one of the many meditations on miscegenation in African-American art history. When first encountering Taboo at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, I was struck by something that seemed at odds with this interpretation, something that reminded me of my research on racial humor and American photography. I immediately associated the painting's horizontally rectangular frame and set of double arches with the unique format of photographic stereo views. These rectangular pieces of cardboard onto which two nearly identical photographs were fixed, were intended to be seen through a binocular instrument known as a stereoscope. When viewed through the device, as we see this woman doing, the images on the card appeared as a single three-dimensional view. Stereo views were immensely popular among white bourgeois Americans between the 1850s and the 1920s, but were falling out of favor as a form of home entertainment during Lawrence's youth. If the painter had indeed set the figures in Taboo within a stereo view, it would suggest that we're not looking at a double wedding at all, but at a picture of a single couple, duplicated and juxtaposed. The repetition of a shadow on the left edge of each arch is certainly consistent with the stereographic format. So too are the changes visible across the two depictions of the couple, since the component photographs of a stereo view were taken precisely 2.5 inches apart to yield the desired three-dimensional effect. Taboo, therefore, can be read as a modernist interpretation of this early photographic form. The content, of course, is just as significant as the form selected. For among the most popular stereoscopic visions at the turn of the 20th century were those that idealized the domestic lives of middle-class men and women. These were frequently distributed in a series that pictured different moments in a heterosexual couple's union, from courtship to the wedding ceremony and early years of marriage. Other series delighted viewers with derogatory images of African-American couples, captioned by caricatured black dialect. At first glance, the stereo card at the bottom of the screen appears to offer a genteel depiction of a Christian country wedding, complete with elegant white dresses for the ladies and suits for the gentlemen. But the materials tacked on the wall behind them tell another story. So does the caption, which translates to, "Honey, do you love your man?" While the dialect and poor spelling in these texts suggest a lack of intelligence among the black churchgoers, the reference to a razor in one of the notices specifically associates their leader with a stereotype then known as the urban coon. The conspicuous price tag on the groom's lapel extends that stereotype to him. There he is, putting on airs, in a store-bought suit that he perhaps intended to return after the ceremony. White viewers were therefore encouraged to read the scene as an affront to Christian virtue and to the sanctity of marriage. Any potential threat to the social order the stereo view might have constituted, however, was assuaged by humor. Lawrence explored the subject of a Christian wedding several times before undertaking Taboo. We see this in The Wedding from 1948 on the left, and in a painting aptly titled Photos from 1952 on the right. In each instance, he portrayed both members of the couple as African American. The tone was solemn and the depiction honorific. This choice of subject and mood subtly challenges popular American stereotypes of marriage as a strictly white institution, and celebrates notions of black love, fidelity, and spirituality. Taboo takes this challenge further, as it combines the conventions of vernacular wedding portraiture with those of comic stereography. That combination can itself be understood as a comic gesture, as it subverts and disarms the assumptions about blackness that informed many stereo views. A second redeployment of racial humor is evident in the manipulation of body color in Taboo. Look carefully, for instance, at the groom with the dark face on the right side of the painting. His face bears a striking similarity to the appearance of a photographic negative, in which the skin of a light-complexioned sitter appears uniformly black. Only his eyes, nose, and mouth would be outlined in white, precisely as we see in Taboo. A dark face would experience just the opposite effect, as in the case of his bride. The reversals of light and dark in the painting suggest that race is not only a matter of perception, but primarily one of illusion. Blacks easily become whites, whites become blacks, races mix, and identities remain unfixed. Reading Taboo as adopting a stereographic format supports that view, for we must remember what happens if we conflate the two sides of the painting into a three-dimensional image. The black groom would overlap with his white counterpart, and the same would occur to the bodies of the brides. Constructed, then, would be a virtual mixing of the races. In referring to photographic positives and negatives, Lawrence may have been reconstructing an old joke. Indeed, the racialization of the positive-negative process became an important feature of photographic humor in the 19th century. Some of the earliest practitioners of photography and popular writers on both sides of the Atlantic remarked upon the laughable absurdity of the medium's reversals of black and white. I'm showing you a detail from the very first book of photographic humor, published in 1855, in which Mr. Brown sees himself in a photographic negative on the right and finds that he is no longer at his best. In this and countless other examples of such humor, the joke managed White's anxieties about photography's effects on the body and social identities. In my article in American Art, I explore at length the many ways in which photography acted upon and through Lawrence's oeuvre. Initially, I found it remarkable that so little had been written about this subject, given the regularity with which photographic references appear in his paintings. But it is, of course, not so surprising when we consider the historiographical problem with which this talk began. What has been said of photography and Lawrence, most recently by art historian Pat Hills, is that his paintings responded to iconic photographs of Black struggle, from the documentary work produced under the Farm Security Administration during the Depression, to the photojournalistic photographs of the Civil Rights Movement. Here is one example cited by Hills. Lawrence's Three Families Share One Toilet from 1943, which is now at the Colby College Museum of Art, where I work. And it evokes a 1941 FSA photograph by Russell Lee titled Toilet in the Basement of an Apartment House Rented to Negroes, Chicago, Illinois. The same photograph by Lee was published in 1941 in 12 Million Black Voices, a photographic book compiled by Richard Wright and Edwin Roskam. My point is that the particular photographs scholars have associated with Lawrence's work have had a critique of racism built into them. In the case of the Lee photograph, if that critique were not staged through the FSA archive, then it was certainly articulated through the photograph's reframing in 12 Million Black Voices. There, it was made to reject the blatant stereotyping that ran through stereoscopic humor. And so the photograph has been deemed safe to associate with Lawrence and his depictions of Harlem life. Any imagery considered otherwise has been omitted from readings of the artist's oeuvre. Here I'm reminded of the heavy criticism that feminist critic Michelle Wallace levied against Facing History at the Corcoran Museum of Art in 1990. Although the landmark exhibition and its catalog significantly expanded the visual material contained in previous surveys of the Black image, it left out a large and important category of African-American representation, namely the derogatory stereotypes of Blacks that pervaded every form of visual culture in 19th century America. Wallace found this erasure troubling and unproductive. In the magazine Art in America, she wrote, quote, "I would hope that the principal purpose for studying images of Blacks in visual art is to gain insight into cultural racism," unquote. For Wallace, such insight comes from thinking deeply about, rather than denying, how African Americans have been degraded through caricature and rendered virtually invisible as subjects and producers of art. There's nothing to be gained, in other words, from simply erasing another form of erasure. Of course, not every African American artist has had his or her work set apart from popular visual humor and its degradation of Black bodies and selves. And I suspect that you've been conjuring up many examples of this. As historian Glenda Carpio demonstrates in her book, Laughing Fit to Kill, there is a rich tradition in African American humor of appropriating and critiquing racial stereotypes, including, if not especially, those that concern interracial relations. She locates this tradition in the contemporary art of Robert Colescott and Kara Walker. For those of you who aren't familiar with these artists, I'm showing you two of their well-known works. On the top is Colescott's George Washington Carver Crossing the Delaware from 1975, which reinterprets through racial caricature Emmanuel Leutz's iconic Washington Crossing the Delaware, which we saw last night in Wendy's talk. And on the bottom is Walker's panoramic arrangement of cut silhouettes titled The End of Uncle Tom and the Grand Allegorical Tableau of Eva in Heaven from 1995, which turns upside down the world of Harriet Beecher Stowe's sentimental novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. According to Carpio, these artists, quote, give life to the most taboo aspects of race and sexuality in America, ultimately seeking to effect a liberating sabotage of the past's hold on the present, unquote. Similarly, Jacob Lawrence's Taboo engages with a taboo subject and adopts the very form and content of a popular racial stereotype. But to see this in the painting requires that images produced outside of the Black community, indeed fantasies of everyday Black life that were manufactured for the viewing pleasure of a white middle class, be allowed to enter African American art historiography. And this is precisely what scholars have been reluctant to do, assuming that such images simply have no place in African American modernism, or fearing the work they might do. There are some artists, Lawrence among them, for whom association with the popular image of the Black has become troubling, if not impossible. They are, we might say, too revered, too ensconced in the canon of African American art to be seen as playing around with racial stereotypes. Recent scholarship on the art of early 20th century New Negro movement, on the early 20th century New Negro movement, points to the long history of this historiographical problem. Art historian Phoebe Wolfskill reminds us, for instance, that in 1943, the African-American scholar James Porter admonished Palmer Hayden for producing what he called satirical pictures of Negro life in Harlem, and specifically in the paintings you see here. The Janitor Who Paints on the left from 1930, and Midsummer Night in Harlem on the right from 1936. Porter declared the humor in The Janitor Who Paints ill-advised, if not altogether tasteless, while comparing Midsummer Night in Harlem to, quote, one of those ludicrous billboards that once were plastered on public buildings to advertise blackface minstrels, unquote. Wolfskill argues that both Hayden and his contemporary, Archibald Motley Jr., complicated white's stereotypical images of the Black, but they did not consistently exhibit the distancing and irony found in art by Robert Colescott and Kara Walker. In fact, she sees the presence of racial caricature in their work as evidence, quote, that pervasive and harmful images of Black identity insinuated themselves in the consciousness of those artists seeking to resist them, unquote. This line of argument brings us back to the historiographical problem at hand, as it assumes that the image of the Black, especially the stuff of racial stereotype, has no proper place or productive role in African-American modernism and the New Negro discourse of self-determination. And so the visual language of Jacob Lawrence's Taboo, a language of racial humor, has itself become taboo in African-American art historiography. To be sure, I am not suggesting that we allow degrading images of Blackness to run amok in the field simply for its own sake. But I am also uncomfortable with policing African-American art history to such an extent that we become blind to the complex visual strategies of modern artists, who reached across the history of art and visual culture well before the advent of postmodernism. At the same time, I remain all too aware of my positionality as a white scholar calling for the uncovering and reintegration of racial humor and stereotyping into American art history. This too makes me uncomfortable, for I would not want to be seen as propagating the assumptions about Blackness expressed through popular images. Contemporary African-American artist Michael Ray Charles observed the discomfort generated by his own image-making in the late 1990s. An artist clearly influenced by Colescott, Charles has become well-known, and some would say infamous, for resuscitating and monumentalizing racist visual tropes, as in this combination of Mickey Mouse and Sambo, both of which are legacies of the minstrel show. The painting's title suggests that we should be beware, but of what exactly? Should we fear the conflation of Sambo with Walt Disney's beloved alter ego? Or should we be afraid of images that erase or deny their own racism, including many images produced by the Disney Corporation? Michael Ray Charles has admitted that the questions he poses through his paintings are not always welcome by viewers and critics. Quote, "A lot of blacks don't want to see images like mine. Perhaps they bring up too much pain," he explained. "A lot of whites are embarrassed and feel ashamed by them. But out of sight, out of mind, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It happened, and I feel it has not been dealt with," unquote. I'd like to leave us, historians of American art, with this sentiment to ponder. My hope is that we will continue to redraw the lines between the image of the Black Studies and African American art history, while keeping in sight and seeking to address the erasures enacted by our historiographical choices.